H110. More info, cinemapolitica.org. This screening series is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
Production Nuit d'Afrique invites you to the gala of the 16th edition of Silly d'Or de la Musique du Monde. See you on Tuesday, April 27th at La Tulipe at 8 p.m. Come and support your favorite artists to help them win the Silly d'Or d'Argent and de Bronze. Throughout the showcase, extraordinary talents emerge each year. Le Silly d'Or de la Musique du Monde is a celebration that brings cultures of the world together. For more information, visit sillydor.com. That's sillydor.com.
What's up? This is Kid Koala. You're listening to CKUT in Montreal, 90.3 FM.
On Doc and this mouth stinking. When we ain't chilling up in the bricks in the Shaolin, we chilling out here in Montreal
on CKUT.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
But CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Thank you very much for tuning in. Today's show is going to be an interview with Butcher T, kind of Montreal's version of Kool Herc, the guy who brought hip hop to Montreal, the guy who, you know, one of the first DJs to really know how to put things together in a hip hop form. So we get into talking about growing up in Montreal and Jamaica at the same time, you know, back and forth. And then, you know, all the influences that had him providing our city with that sound and influencing our city with what was coming from New York at the time. And a whole bunch of other stories talking about, you know, his relationship with DST, Herbie Hancock's DJ, DJing at the Spectrum 84 big breakdance event. And a whole lot more. So, you know, that's CKUT royalty, I should call it, you know. He's been here at the station from the beginning. So enjoy the interview. Thank you very much, Butcher T. Thank you very much for everything that you provided us with and the path that you started us all on. So enjoy the interview. All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM. Peace.
It's like we're in the living room.
Yeah. Shit. Man, just chilling. Chilling with Butcher T.
Yes, it's the place to be.
Yeah, man, Montreal's example of a Kool Herc, you know what I mean? The guy who one of the guys who brought the music here, and I'm sure there's so many stories you have from what you were influenced, like, you know, what influenced you in those times,
stories,
and bringing it here and the reaction from the people and how it just kind of probably took off within the city. So
you're going to like dissect me. You're going to be like picking out what you can pick out of my brain.
Just trying to access. I'm just trying to access the memories. You know, that's my
good,
job.
Good.
You know what I mean? I'm not trying to do anything more than that, but just access the memories and hear your story.
You know, acupuncture when they use the pins there, you're going to be doing it verbally.
Yeah, man. So, you were born in Montreal?
Yeah, born in Montreal. I had the best of both worlds, you know. My parents both Jamaican, so I had the privilege in living in Jamaica. Went to school there for a bit, then came back to Montreal, and I used to go back and forth. So, you know, so I had the culture of, I'm a musical junkie. Mm-hmm. Because in Jamaica now, when you're in Jamaica now, everybody thinks Jamaica's like reggae music, but in Jamaica you hear country.
Yeah,
you hear R&B. You hear the side A's and you hear the side B's. So side B's would be the unknown.
Yeah.
But in Jamaica, though, the side B, they'll make it known or whatever. You know what I mean?
To explain that to somebody listening, the side A would be the big hit, whatever the single would be. And the side B, it's like, oh, let me give something to the people that
exactly.
might not be on the album or might be the kind of lesser known.
But they always made the side B.
Yeah.
You know, the side A was there, but they made the side B a hit. I mean, but anyways, what I'm saying, like, in Jamaica, there was so much of a variety of music. So how I was exposed to the music, there was a family house in Kingston, Rollington Town. And we had a bar, a corner bar, the family owned. So I used to wake up to music and go to sleep to music. So it's like, you know, people putting money in the jukebox, you know, so like the guy's coming. Okay, at night, okay, say at night, I'm hearing music when people's there drinking. You're hearing all kinds of, you hear Jerry Butler. You hear Africa Unite, Batsilele.
Africa Unite, Batsilele. Some welcome, friends and comrades all, to here at Amandla, live from the studio for our second time in the longest time, and we're still getting used to sitting at the mix and looking at each other across the table. But welcome back to Amandla, your regular news show for about news and analysis and briefings on the continent of Africa. This week, it's going to be bilingual, because I'm going to cover Dawn Feminist. les partenariats publics-privés, le Code du Sénégal. Dans un impressionnant collectif féministe a rassemblé une série de présentations très puissantes dénonçant la façon dont les PPP, les partenariats publics-privés, perpétuent la relation coloniale avec l'Afrique. Donc, c'est ça, on va jouer un premier épisode de ça. Et Gwen, qu'est-ce qu'on a?
So tonight in English, we'll be kicking off the show in English. Welcome, everybody. And we're going to be taking a look at Sudan. So as you are all painfully aware, the situation right there right now is critical, to put it mildly. But mainstream media is tending to focus more and more on how to evacuate international diplomats. So we want to go way deeper than that tonight and talk about why the conflict is going on, talk about how the people are experiencing the conflict. And we have with us a special guest, Duha El-Mardi. I will introduce you to her in a moment. Welcome back to Amanda here on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. In 2018, 2019, all of us sat up and took note and inspiration as the people of Sudan peacefully took to the streets and brought down a dictator, Omar al-Bashir. It was a youthful and youth-driven movement, and one that in particular galvanized women to play a central role. The armed forces moved in to physically remove al-Bashir from power, and then in 2021 turned on the people, working hard to thwart their plans for a truly free and democratic Sudan. That struggle continues to this day, but now the two top generals, one at the head of the Sudan Armed Forces and the other at the head of the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary organization, have turned on each other, and in the process are raining bombs and bullets down on the people, in particular in the capital, Khartoum, and in the region of Darfur. Duha El-Mardi joins us in the studio tonight to help us understand what's going on and where it leaves the people's struggle for a democratic and people-run Sudan. Duha is a Sudanese resident based in Montreal, a graduate student at Concordia University, an activist, and has been an inspiring and insightful voice for us here on Amandla on a number of occasions. So Duha, welcome back to Amandla.
Thank you so much, Gwen, and thank you for having me back. It's good to see you all again. I wish it was in a better occasion.
Yes, but, me too. Sad circumstances, but really nice to be sitting here with you nonetheless. So can you explain to us what led to this explosive conflict between these two armed forces?
Yeah. So first off, I want to start with, thinking about all the innocent lives that we've lost in these past few days, but also throughout the history, really, of dealing with all these different regimes. So glory and mercy to all the innocent lives that we've lost in Sudan. May those who are wounded heal, and may those who are missing return. In the early morning of April 15th, it was a very normal day in Sudan, and then people across Khartoum, and as you said, in Darfur as well, different parts of Darfur, woke up to loud sounds of explosions in different parts of the city, heavy gunfire that was happening. At that moment, people, of course, started to tune into media, TV, to see what's going on. And it was becoming more clear that a war between the Sudanese armed forces, they're also known as SAF, S-A-F, through its general, as you mentioned, General Al-Burhan, as well as the Rapid Support Forces, formerly known as the Janjaweed Militia, through its leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, is also known as Hemeti. A quick refresher on the Rapid Support Forces.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Or the Janjaweed. So these are Arab pastoralist militias that were based in Darfur, and it has a long history of violence in Sudan. Particularly during the period of al-Bashir's regime and the NCP, They played an instrumental role in the situation in Darfur, in the war, in the genocide against people there. Throughout the period of 2003 to 2009, they were fighting on behalf of al-Bashir there and on behalf of the National Congress Party. You know, they had a big role to play in the more than 300,000 people who were killed there and the millions of people who were displaced. They were rebranded by al-Bashir in 2013. That's the period when we start seeing the name changing from Janjaweed to Rapid Support Forces. Because during that time, al-Bashir was starting to feel a little bit of threat from factions of the military, as well as factions within the national intelligence. So he was scared that these people were going to try to do a coup on him. So he seized that opportunity to connect more with the Rapid Support Forces and actually give them a more of a protector status to him. So they actually got, in 2017, he gave them a base, a permanent base in Khartoum. So he had a huge role to play in legitimizing this militia. And of course, the Rapid Support Forces themselves have been... they have a lot of sources of wealth that that allowed them to be this powerful as well. You know, they have control. They have had control of different gold mines in Sudan, the Jabal Amir, for example, which is sort of northwest, 200 kilometers northwest to Al-Fashir in North Darfur, and other gold mines that they own. They were also, you know, they also do military contracting for some countries. The war in Yemen, for example, and they fought on behalf of Saudi Arabia in Yemen.
So a mercenary kind of force.
Yes, absolutely. And they also actually were protecting some gold mines in Libya as well. So, he was able to generate a lot of wealth through all these different things that he was doing. And also, I think one thing that often gets missed out in the conversation about Hemeti is the role that he had to play in the European Union's Horn of Africa Migration Route Initiative, also known as the Khartoum process, which happened in 2014. And it was basically a process around curbing migration to Europe. So he had a role to play in that in regards to curbing migration to Libya and others.
Specifically through military might?
Yes. So that's something that often gets not discussed a lot, but yeah. And the Sudanese Armed Forces itself, of course, has a lot of military investment. So they also have a lot of source of wealth and power. So yeah. So you mentioned the 2021 military coup where Hemeti was actually the deputy for al-Burhan, right? So he was the deputy, and they were ruling through this military council before that, and then they did the coup together. So they were sort of partners. Although since the coup in 2021, they were never actually able to form a government. For example, there was a lot of disagreements and things like that. And then since mid last year, we were seeing a little bit more of the tension that was between them. And at that time, you know, Al-Burhan actually brought in some of the Islamist NCP officials to be a part of the council because he was really losing legitimacy at that point after the coup. There were not a lot of people who wanted to be a part of that government. So he actually brought in a lot of the Islamist people back. So that was also a point of, you know, of course, the coup itself was something that was very devastating to the revolution and very devastating to the people. And then the fact that he brought in Islamists to be there, too, was, you know, was really just very detrimental
Bringing
to
back the
progress.
Old guard.
Yes. Yeah. So a few months before this position that we're in right now, the United Nations was working with them on this framework agreement, basically, bringing in together the RSF, SAF, some parts of the Forces of Freedom of Change to basically sort of create a framework agreement that potentially lends itself into an agreement, a process of working together. And so this was pushed by the Troika, pushed by the United Nations, despite the fact that this framework has having no popular support whatsoever. The people were very clearly rejecting this. The resistance committees, who played an instrumental role in the revolution and really the only form of democratic grassroots leadership that was going on that truly represented people was excluded out of this whole framework, you know? So it wasn't a popular framework. A lot of people have brought up so many gaps and issues within it, but all of that was ignored, and this process was getting rushed. And so in late March, there was a workshop around that the UN was doing through this framework around, I think, like security reform or something like that. And the RSF was there, the army was there. And I think the army, there was some sort of disagreement, and the army had stormed off after that session. And so that was like the beginning of really, this was like end of March, very, very recent. And so that was the beginning of like people kind of noticing that there was some real issues that were coming up between them. And then, you know, Hemeti afterwards started moving in some of his troops more into Khartoum. Mm-hmm. And of course, the military didn't like that.
And I gather that under this draft agreement, there was also a plan to merge the two forces. And so, you know, there was the armed forces was saying one merger within 1 year. Yeah. And then the Janjaweed were saying, no, we want a 10 year. Yeah. And that also was contributed to.
Yes, absolutely. I think the military was saying 2 years and the Janjaweed was saying 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so there was clearly these people were not going to agree with each other. And again, like, while all of this was happening, people continued to not believe in this framework or process. And people continued to basically say, this doesn't work. You can't turn these people into reformists. It's not going to work, you know?
Yeah, so it's a reassertion of elite power and the status quo. And, well, let's talk about the people then, because they are obviously the other part of the story and the most important one. So you've referred to the resistance committees, and then there was this kind of coalition that came to be known as the Forces for Freedom and Change. And they've been contending with this kind of derailment of the revolution for the last 3 years or so. So how now are these structures dealing with what, I know it's early days, I'm sure some of them saw it coming. How are they dealing with it now?
Yeah, I honestly can't speak about the Forces of Freedom of Change. I've seen some statements come out from them. I think they're just not in the picture right now. Mm. I don't
Why?
Know. You know, maybe I'm also just because, like many people, I have been very frustrated with their positioning for a while.
Which is what? Just to explain.
I mean, just from the beginning, from the 2019 agreement, a lot of people have you know, rejected that agreement to begin with. The power sharing between the civilians through the Prime Minister Hamdok and the military. Like, you know, a lot of people could see that from very early on that this wasn't going to lead anywhere. And the resistance committees and people continued, you know, while that agreement happened, people continued to protest. Mm-hmm. It's not like the streets were silent. People rejected that. And that was all ignored, you know, and it's really the situation where a lot of them, unfortunately, are political elites who mm-hmm. ignored voices of people and went on with, you know, whatever that was happening. So there's a lot of frustration around their positions. So I'm not honestly very tuned in, and mm-hmm. I've seen one statement come from them, but I'm not tuned in. Maybe there's more. I'm just not tuned into
that. Well, tell us more about the resistance committees, and maybe just give us a little bit of a background, because a lot of our listeners are not going to know what we're talking about.
Yeah. So the resistance committees, we call it Lijan al-Muqawama in Sudan, they are grassroots committees that are formed out of different neighborhoods. And basically, they were organizing during the time of the protest. They were organizing things like, for example, protest routes, march routes, giving people instructions, trying to keep people safe in these occasions. But they were also organizing a lot of mutual aid in neighborhood, especially during times of a lot of direct action, where some streets would be blocked as a form of direct action, then people, you know, would need access to go buy food or go to schools or go to hospitals. So they played a lot of role in organizing the daily lives, of course, in the disappearance of a social system that takes care of that. They played some of that role. And so they were very integral, and they're also very connected, and they're connected with each other through some regional. So these committees are all over Sudan, not just Khartoum. There's committees in small villages in the north, you know, everywhere, in different parts of Darfur. And it truly was something that really, it was, you know, it was boys and girls and you know, youth in the neighborhood mm-hmm. that were coming together and we're saying, we can do better than this, you know? Yeah. It's really inspiring. And I think people need to really recognize more the role of the Resistance Committee yeah. and how sophisticated they're actually, that what they've been doing is.
How are they coping now?
I think a lot of them at the moment are still back doing a lot of mutual aid stuff. This is a very, very difficult time. A lot of hospitals we've lost a lot of hospitals at this point. I think it's like last time I checked a couple of days ago, it was over 50 hospitals are destroyed and that there's 23 hospitals functioning all over Sudan.
Wow.
Yeah. So some hospitals, of course, were directly attacked. And some hospitals have lost capacity to function due to staff fatigue, due to just not being able to access supplies anymore, things like that. There were some hospitals that had no water for days, you know.
And I gather health personnel also, a lot of them are trapped in their homes. They can't even get to work.
Exactly. Some of them are working, you know, despite all of that. And some of them, you know, aren't. So the resistance committees are right now filling in a lot of those gaps and even just helping out in some. And I want to say this is not just the resistance committees. This is really almost everyone, at least the people that I know, are all hands on deck. Like everyone is really helping out their neighbors. Everyone is it's like, you have to also understand that it's not only that people are dealing with the brutality of what's going on. So like airstrikes, mortar shells in their houses, bullets coming in through your windows. Like I have family that have experienced this and are still experiencing this level of terror. But also that means that things that you have normally have access to in your daily life, you can't because you're trapped in your house. You can't access, even if you have money, people are not able to get cash out because the banks are closed. So even if you have money, you have no access to your money. You can't really do anything at this point. The stores are mostly shut down. I think some of them are a little bit opened up right now. But like there would be days where, you know, everything is shut. And then there are people who need insulin, who need, you know, who have chronic illnesses, disabilities, elders who are like, you know, who need special care. All of these people are, you know, feeling and experiencing all these things. So it's not just the brutality of it, but also the impact of all these things on people who live through different vulnerabilities.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. It's important for people to hear that. So Sudan doesn't exist in a vacuum and has long been the target of some pretty nefarious international interest because of its wealth, because of its strategic location. So do you have sort of any sense of the role of international players, both in perhaps stoking this and also in perhaps trying to get things back on track?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to be really careful because I think my focus in this time has really been with my family and with my friends and what everybody else is going through and the different evacuation things that are going on, the different, you know, my energy has really mostly been focused on that stuff. So I would say that I'm not fully, and also I want to say that there's a lot of contradicting news that comes from both sides, right? Because both sides have their own propaganda machines and both sides are putting out very contradicting information. There's a lot of false information that is circulating online. There are some groups that are doing fact-checking, like Beam Reports. They're constantly doing fact-checking on videos that are coming out and things like that. But it's very difficult at this point to really kind of follow up on everything. But of course, throughout the history of Sudan, and especially throughout this revolution, we know that there were forces and different regions and different alliances that were formed, both with Hemeti. Like, for example, Hemeti has alliances with the United Arab Emirates, you know. Egypt has very strong alliances with Egypt. But so does Al-Burhan. Al-Burhan also has alliances with the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah, it's very
complicated. Yes, and so both of them have strategic alliances. And at this point, it's very unclear how these alliances will shift, you know, especially given that you know, we've seen that the war in Yemen is coming to an end now with this, with these agreements mm-hmm. that are being formed. Hopefully that's what happens. But that impacts the relationship of Hamiti with the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, as he's no longer needed as much as he would have been needed in Yemen. You know, so there are these small details, but I think, yeah, I think it's interesting to see how these dynamics are going to shift. I mm-hmm. think there's definitely going to be a shift in alliances. I think we would, you know, it's been really sad seeing the role of the global community in this situation. It's been really, really like heartbreaking to see, you know, of course, like over the past couple of days, we're seeing diplomats being evacuated, the, you know, UN agencies, different NGOs pulling their people out and leaving. But that also means that the people of Sudan are really left by themselves yeah. to deal with everything that's going on and to keep their people safe and, you know, and to deal with these geopolitical things that are happening when people are just trying to survive, you know. And so it's really sad seeing that. And like, actually, I think it was yesterday that I was seeing that the British Air Force had informed British citizens in Sudan that there's an evacuation that's coming. And so everybody rushed to go. And it was like in this Wadi Sayyidina, just a military base in Omdurman, it really in the middle of nowhere, very far to get to. And all these families, hundreds of families have went there, and Sudanese British were left out.
Yeah.
They just left. They left and, you know, they said there's no capacity mm-hmm. and maybe we will come back. Maybe, I don't know, right yeah. now.
Well, I know the Canadian embassy has evacuated the diplomatic staff, but they left all the Sudanese yeah. employees behind because yeah. they said the paperwork was just, they would eventually get to it, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. yeah.
Which unfortunately yeah. is kind of, tends to be classic yeah. in these conflicts.
Absolutely. So I think everyone really in the global community is not pulling their weight mm-hmm. at all.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we saw recently there was the 3-day ceasefire that was brokered by the United States. I want to say, like, the previous ceasefire during Eid that was announced was not respected. 6 minutes after the ceasefire, there was already gunfire. This new ceasefire that's announced has already been broken within a couple of hours. So on the media, we see on the external level, there's these ceasefire agreements happening. But on the ground, that's not actually happening mm-hmm. at all.
So you're in touch with your family yeah. and your friends and people within the resistance. And, you know, is there a message coming out about how they see the future? How do they see the way out of this?
Yeah, I think...
I know they're contending right now with the immediate crisis, so it's hard. But is there any kind of anything coming out in terms of, you know, how to move forward?
Yeah, I think the one thing that's still very strong is that people are, for the most part, not taking any sides in this. And that's very important. And it's very important, too, for the global community to recognize that this is not a war of the Sudanese people. This is not a civilian war. It's not a civil war that, you know, yeah. like it could. We hope not, but it could. But it's not a civil war. This is really a fight between two factions of the military and militia. And it's a struggle over power. And people are not taking sides at this point because both sides have been historically oppressive to the Sudanese people. But at the same time, as you said, people are obviously very much, you know, busy with just trying to make sure that they have enough food, that they have water. Some parts, you know, some places still don't have electricity since the first day of this happened, and water. You know, so those things. But also there's a lot of people who are moving around in different states. I have family members who've went to different states. And this time, of course, moving around is very difficult. So it's not easy for people to make that decision to evacuate. It's a very difficult decision, yeah. very difficult decision to leave your whole life behind. You have no idea if you were ever come back to this yeah. place or not. And I think there's a huge situation in the border with Egypt that also there's no media coverage. It's a terrible situation right now at the border. People are waiting for days. They're not given food or water or medication. And there's like hundreds and hundreds of buses that are like people that are going there on a daily basis. The buses have prices are going at this. Yesterday when I checked, it was $500 per person.
Aye, aye, aye.
For the bus that takes you to the Wadi Halfa or to Ergin. And then you still have to do, and there's still the visa requirement for Egypt for men 50 years and below. So these men still have to go there, still have to apply for a visa, wait until your visa is issued, and then you go. So it could take 2-3 days for people to be there with no support whatsoever, no assistance, no access, no orientation. You know, and these are people that are escaping, you know, terror that they've been living with for the past few days. So that's also not getting any coverage or attention. And that's just one border, you know. There's on the west, people are living through Chad as well. Some people are living through South Sudan, Ethiopia.
Yeah. So you've mentioned a couple of times how highly propagandized this story is. Do you have any sources that you consider reliable that you could direct our listeners to if they want to continue to kind of keep an eye on what's going on and be informed and hopefully ultimately be able to put some kind of pressure on our government to play a constructive role?
Yeah, there's a website that's called, I think, SudanCoup.com, and it gets updated pretty regularly. And there's also a fundraiser by the Sudanese American Physicians Association. They do a lot of great work. They're on the ground there. They're one of the very few organizations that are actually on the ground in Sudan in this time. And so there's an online fundraiser through the short term is SAPA, S-A-P-A. So that's a place that people can go definitely to donate. They do mainly medical assistance. They're supporting doctors and hospitals. But yeah, and also keep an eye out. I think a lot of Sudanese communities in different cities. I know in Ottawa, there's going to be a protest on a march on this Saturday. I know in Toronto, there's some stuff happening as well. So keep an eye on, you know, what the Sudanese communities, the forms of action that they're doing. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. Well, listen, I really appreciate that you came and joined us, and our thoughts are with your friends and family and all the rest of the people in Sudan, and we'll continue to follow this. Thanks so much, Dua.
Thank you.
Well, those are the vocals of Harry Belafonte, and he died yesterday at the age of 96 in New York City of congestive heart failure. He was a hero of mine, and my mother's as well, transcending generations, for different reasons, of course. That song is in English, Show Me the Way, My Brother, Ipindela. It's off the album of Harry Belafonte and Mary McCabe. He started including her in his shows in the late 60s as part of his commitment to the anti-apartheid movement. And as a man, he made it very clear in his interviews and his philosophical expressions that he was an activist first for human rights, dignity for black people and struggle for social justice. And an artist second in aid of that cause, all those causes. So this song in Zulu is done, and the title, Show Me the Way, My Brother, Ipindile, is part of the whole element of supporting and making known the cause of what was going on in South Africa at a time when it was an extremely unknown and ignored and in misrepresented struggle. So there is our very short and modest goodbye to Harry Belafonte, a real hero of the struggle for Africa and its freedom and its social justice around the world. He'll be missed, but his records and his history and his stands stand strong. Well, Dawn, ça c'est le Alternative de Développement avec les Femmes pour une Nouvelle Ère, en anglais, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era. Sur l'Internet, on peut le trouver à Dawn, dawnnet.org. Et eux autres, c'est un impressionnant collectif féministe qui travaillait ensemble depuis les dernières années des 80, l'époque 80. Et un de leurs focus importants, c'est les partenariats public-privés, PPP, qui sont expliqués très bien dans cet épisode qu'on va jouer tout de suite. C'est le cas du Sénégal. Dans cet épisode, les chercheuses féministes Fatou Sou et Merem Noy Faye montrent comment ce modèle au Sénégal, sous la forme de nouvelles autoroutes, aussi innocentes, ça a l'air anodine, là, a eu un impact extrêmement négatif sur les femmes. Le modèle PPP enrichit les entreprises impliquées, laisse au gouvernement le fardeau de la dette et les retombées sociales négatives, surtout sur les femmes. Donc, on va jouer celle-ci avec l'encouragement des gens de Dawn, D-E-W-N, et on t'encourage à s'informer vis-à-vis qu'est-ce qu'il fait Dawn, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era, Alternatives de Développement avec les Femmes pour une Nouvelle Ère, dawnnet.org. Donc, ici, Old Dogs, New Tricks, le Code du Sénégal.
Bienvenue dans la série de podcasts Dawn sur les partenariats publics-privés. Je suis Fatou Sow, sociologue, membre du conseil d'administration de Dawn. Cette série propose une analyse féministe du Sud sur cet important thème socio-économique. Nous examinerons en profondeur les réalités du développement international contemporain, les pratiques néocoloniales et la mainmise des entreprises sur l'État. On parle de marchandisation de la gouvernance, qui est le titre d'un ouvrage publié par Dawn sous la direction de Vivienne Taylor, membre également du conseil d'administration de Dawn. Nous vous invitons à nous rejoindre alors que nous examinons ces défis et imaginons un monde équitable et juste pour tous. Bonjour, bonsoir. Je m'appelle Fatou Sow. Je suis sociologue sénégalaise. Aujourd'hui, nous allons discuter avec Dr Merem Noy de la responsabilité des entreprises et des droits humains. Nous allons tenter d'étudier, d'avoir une approche féministe des projets, partenariats privés. On appelle partenariat public-privé un partenariat comme moyen privilégié de réaliser des projets d'infrastructure comme la fourniture d'énergie, par exemple l'eau, l'électricité, des projets de transport, qu'il s'agisse d'autoroutes, de routes, de ponts, d'échangeurs, les télécommunications, des radios, télévisions, mais également l'accès à Internet, les aménagements agro-industriels ou bien des équipements d'éducation et de santé. Alors, ces partenariats public-privé, ce n'est pas récent. Le mouvement émergent que l'on a au Sénégal, qui naît à partir des années 1990, est lié à ce contexte particulier. Ce contexte est celui des politiques d'ajustement structurel qui ont projeté de mettre l'Afrique dans l'économie mondiale libérale et de pousser à des réformes qui répondaient à un modèle théorique de l'économie de marché. La globalisation et la mondialisation a entraîné plusieurs pans de l'économie africaine dans ce secteur. Ces politiques amenaient les États à se désengager, c'est-à-dire à abandonner plusieurs secteurs d'investissement lourds et les ont poussés à transférer ces compétences à des collectivités locales. C'est ainsi que le président Abdou Diouf, qui était le président du Sénégal de 1980 à l'année 2000, avait comme slogan politique, c'est « moins d'État, mieux d'État ». C'est-à-dire moins d'État intervient dans l'économie, mieux l'économie se porte. Mais pour que les collectivités locales, c'est-à-dire les départements, les régions, le milieu rural ou le milieu urbain, puissent investir, c'était impossible de le faire à partir des budgets locaux. Donc on a pensé que l'appui du secteur privé serait utile pour combler le manque d'argent. Et c'est ainsi que l'on a établi des partenariats publics-privés. Alors ces partenariats, ils ont fait l'objet de choix et ils ont fait l'objet de montages financiers. C'est-à-dire qu'on a établi des budgets, on a vu qui apportait plus ou moins d'argent. Mais en fait, ces partenariats, l'un des grands problèmes rencontrés dès le départ, c'est qu'ils ont été très peu discutés entre l'État et les collectivités qui recevaient ces infrastructures. Dr. Mayam Doui, vous avez la parole. Est-ce que vous pouvez vous présenter?
Merci pour cette invitation. Alors, moi, c'est Dr. Mayam Doui. Je suis économiste et enseignante-chercheure à la Faculté des sciences économiques et de gestion. Donc, j'ai travaillé avec le BOND dans le cadre d'une étude sur les partenariats publics-privés et le respect des droits humains, notamment le droit des femmes.
Ah, merci beaucoup. Donc, je vais vous poser une première question. Vous avez fait une étude de cas pour Doun, qui était le Sénégal, avec un projet spécifique. J'aimerais que vous nous parliez d'abord du contexte, d'abord le contexte historique, nous expliquer pourquoi un tel projet a été mis en œuvre et qu'est-ce qui s'est passé plus récemment depuis la rédaction de l'étude de cas. Nous allons peut-être commencer par vous demander de présenter l'étude de cas que vous avez soumise.
Alors, dans le cadre de ce travail, nous avons su une étude de cas de l'autoroute à péage Dakar-Diamniadio, qui est un cas de partenariat public-privé. Alors, l'intérêt pour cette étude, c'est que d'abord, on est dans un contexte où ce mode de financement est devenu une solution de recours pour le gouvernement, mais également qu'on fait face à des situations où on a des difficultés à financer les projets de développement qui coûtent assez cher. Donc, face à cette contrainte, le partenariat public-privé s'est présenté comme une alternative pour le gouvernement de financer des projets de développement. Alors, le cas de l'autoroute à péage est un cas pratique de partenariat public-privé. C'est un projet qui date de très longtemps, depuis le premier président de la République du Sénégal. Mais malheureusement, ce projet n'avait pas pu être réalisé du fait de contraintes de financement. Et c'est après la première alternance que ce projet a été remis sur la table et a pu bénéficier d'un partenariat public-privé pour être réalisé. Donc voilà un peu le contexte dans lequel nous avons choisi ce cas pratique qui a suscité beaucoup d'engouement, qui a suscité beaucoup de discussions sur la place publique, sur les médias également, sur beaucoup d'aspects, sur la pertinence même de ce projet, sur la pertinence du financement, du mode de financement, mais également sur le coût. Donc, il y a beaucoup d'enjeux qui ont été portés, d'où l'intérêt que nous avons accordé à cette pratique.
Et combien de temps a duré le projet et est-ce qu'on peut déjà, dès maintenant, commencer à tirer des conclusions de ce projet? Est-ce qu'il a été bénéfique pour les populations? Est-ce que les femmes en ont profité? Est-ce qu'il y a eu des difficultés? Est-ce qu'on peut déjà faire une sorte d'évaluation de l'impact du projet?
Alors, si c'est en termes de pertinence du projet, le projet a été un moyen de faciliter la mobilité parce que compte tenu de la configuration géographique, la seule sortie de Dakar, c'était la route nationale. Et donc, ce projet était une alternative qui permettait de faciliter la mobilité entre Dakar et des autres régions. Et j'avoue qu'en termes de pertinence, c'est un projet qui a été pertinent. Mais c'est un projet également qui a eu des impacts négatifs parce que c'est un trajet qui était habitable. C'est des quartiers qui se sont trouvés découpés en deux. C'est également des critiques sur le coût engendré par le projet. Donc, en termes de pertinence, oui, c'est un projet qui est pertinent, mais également, il faut souligner qu'il y a des effets négatifs du projet sur lesquels il faut tirer des leçons pour les prochaines expériences, pour des expériences de partenariat public-privé.
Est-ce que vous pouvez donner un exemple d'impact négatif?
Par exemple, un impact négatif, c'est le projet qui passe par un quartier où sont implantées des infrastructures scolaires, des infrastructures de santé, des populations qui ont leur habitude, qui ont tissé des liens de fraternité, d'amitié, des zones où, par exemple, vous avez des populations avec des niveaux de revenus assez bas. Et qu'à travers ce circuit de connaissances, de relations humaines qu'ils ont pu établir, le fait de les délocaliser a créé un impact négatif. Vous dispersez, par exemple, deux voisins qui pouvaient s'entraider mutuellement, c'est un impact négatif. Le cas d'un établissement scolaire également qui a été délocalisé ou bien compensé. Mais cette compensation ne peut pas compenser la perte que l'établissement a subie. Donc ça, c'est des cas pratiques. C'est vrai qu'il y a des mesures d'accompagnement, des mesures de compensation, mais il faudrait, au-delà des règles prescrites, tenir compte de cet aspect culturel, cet aspect social qui constitue une réalité du terrain.
Bien, je voudrais peut-être poser une question. C'est à propos des femmes pauvres et de leur communauté. Quel a été l'impact du projet? Est-ce que le projet leur a donné des activités ou bien le projet a supprimé les faibles activités que ces femmes pouvaient avoir? Est-ce que sur le plan non seulement d'activité, mais sur le plan de la circulation, sur le plan de l'accès au marché, l'accès à d'autres infrastructures, est-ce que ça a été facilité ou ça a été rendu plus difficile?
Concrètement, le projet en tant que tel n'a pas pris en compte ces aspects, même s'il y a des mesures de compensation pour déplacer les populations. Ce qui est arrivé dans ce cas de figure, c'est dans le cadre de la responsabilité sociétale de l'entreprise que la société, le concessionnaire, a pu accompagner les femmes pour réduire les impacts négatifs, les accompagner en termes d'activités génératrices de revenus pour relever le niveau de vie de ces femmes. Mais il faut reconnaître que le projet en tant que tel a eu des effets négatifs sur les femmes particulièrement qui, comme je te disais tout à l'heure, ont pu avoir des réseaux qui leur permettent de subvenir à certains besoins. Et le fait de les délocaliser, de les séparer des lieux de marché, de les séparer de certains centres d'intérêt a constitué un impact. Par exemple, si c'est toute la localité qui était déplacée en même temps vers une autre localité, là, ça aurait été beaucoup plus simple parce qu'on garde les mêmes liens. Mais le fait de disperser, ça pose problème.
Alors maintenant, je vais peut-être revenir à des points clés que nous avons pris de votre étude de cas. Vous nous avez expliqué qu'au fond, les institutions de Bretton Woods, après les programmes d'ajustement structurel des années 80, ont mis en place des mécanismes pour aider les États africains et les États sénégalais à financer des projets de développement. Et à ce niveau-là, on a eu tout un discours sur le besoin pour le pays d'avoir de grands projets d'infrastructure pour moderniser le pays. Et moi qui viens à Dakar, je sais qu'il y a eu tout un programme d'autoroutes, d'échangeurs autour, dans le Cap-Vert, qui est la région dans laquelle se trouve Dakar, où est le programme EFAGE, qui est un programme d'autoroute. En ce même temps, on peut se demander, est-ce qu'il était nécessaire à ce niveau-là d'avoir recours au financement privé? Est-ce qu'il y avait des problèmes budgétaires? Et le fait que le plan Sénégal émergent se concentre sur de grands projets, comment est-ce qu'on en est arrivé à favoriser ce partenariat public-privé?
Effectivement, comme vous l'avez noté, dans les années 80, avec l'intervention des institutions de Bretton Woods, le pays a fait face à des politiques d'ajustement. Il faut savoir que c'était dans un contexte de pression budgétaire. Et on est dans un pays où la plupart des ressources budgétaires proviennent de recettes fiscales. Et dans ce contexte, vous voyez qu'il y a beaucoup de priorités pour l'État. Il y a les priorités relatives à la santé, relatives à l'éducation, relatives aux infrastructures. La différence entre les infrastructures et d'autres services qui sont offerts, c'est qu'il y a des services comme les infrastructures qui peuvent attirer des investisseurs privés parce qu'une autoroute à péage peut être rentable financièrement. Comparé, par exemple, à d'autres types d'investissements, je parle par exemple de l'éclairage public, un privé n'a aucun intérêt à s'y lancer. Le point commun, c'est qu'on fait face à un État qui a beaucoup de priorités à la fois, la santé, l'éducation, les infrastructures et d'autres axes qui sont définis dans le cadre du plan Sénégal émergent également, et fait face à une contrainte de financement. Et il y a des activités qui intéressent le secteur privé. Donc, ça doit être un partenariat gagnant-gagnant. Et l'État a mis en place un cadre institutionnel pour pouvoir attirer les investisseurs étrangers et promouvoir le partenariat privé. Malheureusement, lorsqu'on est dans ce mode de financement, les investisseurs ont beaucoup plus d'éléments pour tirer profit de ce mode de financement que le gouvernement. Et le risque maintenant, c'est que c'est la partie privée qui gagne plus que la partie publique. Et donc, pourquoi on est arrivé à cette situation? C'est principalement du fait de contraintes de financement, la pression budgétaire, beaucoup de priorités en même temps et il faut faire des arbitrages. Et des activités qui peuvent intéresser le privé, on préfère laisser le privé s'en occuper sous forme de partenariat public-privé.
Oui, mais on se rend compte, et vous dites également dans le rapport, au fond, ce privé, c'est un privé étranger. C'est très rarement un privé local. Et là, vous dites à un moment, vous écrivez dans le rapport, hein, les intérêts du partenariat privé n'ont aucun rapport avec l'éthique économique musulmane. Vous pensez que l'éthique économique musulmane est moins intéressée à l'intérêt que l'éthique économique chinoise ou bien française qui est là? Parce que quand la Turquie, qui est un État laïque, mais qui a des prétentions de lien et d'éthique musulmane, et le président turc l'affirme à tout bout de champ, quand tu fais un aéroport ou quand tu participes à la construction de l'aéroport, est-ce que vous pensez qu'à ce moment-là, l'éthique musulmane peut jouer? Est-ce qu'il n'y a pas une question d'intérêt? Et à ce moment-là, on peut se demander, est-ce que le Sénégal n'aurait pas pu privilégier des privés locaux?
Oui, effectivement, ça c'est une préoccupation, parce que la plupart du temps, c'est des firmes étrangères qui gagnent ces marchés-là, et au détriment de nos entreprises. Dans le contexte sénégalais, c'est vrai qu'on a l'expertise des fois qu'il faut, mais le financement de ces activités est assez consistant. Et malheureusement, notre système financier n'est pas assez soutenable pour permettre à nos entreprises locales de faire face à ces entreprises étrangères, je dirais même à ces géants étrangers. Donc, ce qui fait que quand un marché est lancé, il y a de fortes chances que ça soit une entreprise étrangère qui gagne le marché. Parce que l'entreprise locale, il doit être soutenu financièrement, avoir l'expertise qu'il faut. Et c'est à ce moment-là que dans les contrats de partenariat privé, qu'il faut aller vers le sens d'un équilibre où le privé y gagne parce que lui, ce qu'il cherche, c'est son intérêt. C'est une rentabilité financière qu'il cherche. L'État qui veille à l'intérêt collectif. Et l'intérêt collectif, c'est pour lui de mettre en place ses infrastructures, mais également en faire tirer profit aux populations. Et quand on dit population, c'est les ménages, c'est les entreprises également. Donc, il doit y avoir un cadre qui permet, même si c'est une firme étrangère qui y gagne, que des entreprises locales puissent être impliquées pour capitaliser cette expérience-là pour de futurs projets. Mais malheureusement, une firme, ça reste une firme, son intérêt financier. Et nous sommes dans un contexte culturel, avec des considérations culturelles, des considérations coutumières, qu'il va falloir prendre en compte, tout en permettant à l'État d'atteindre ses objectifs, c'est-à-dire de produire des infrastructures qui sont utiles pour le développement du pays, pour la circulation, pour l'approvisionnement des clients. Parce qu'il faut dire, par exemple, que le cas que j'ai pris d'autoroute à péage, elle est assez importante pour la circulation des personnes, mais également pour la circulation des biens de Dakar vers l'intérieur du pays.
Au fond, on a des projets de développement économique qui sont tenus par le secteur privé. Comment est-ce que ces projets prennent en compte des besoins des populations, et notamment des besoins de population des femmes, des besoins de genre, comme on dit?
Alors, il faut voir qu'on est dans un contexte où le Sénégal a pratiquement ratifié tous les accords en rapport avec la protection des femmes. Et même au niveau institutionnel, au niveau de chaque département ministériel, il doit y avoir un point focal genre. Donc, c'est pour dire l'intérêt qui devrait être accordé à la prise en compte des aspects genre dans toutes les activités. Mais malheureusement, pour certains départements, il n'y a pas ce point focal genre-là. Et pour le cadre des PPP, on verra que dans tous les textes relatif à la loi sur les PPP, l'aspect genre n'est pas pris en compte. Ce n'est cité nulle part. Et ce qui fait que là, c'est une faiblesse. C'est une faiblesse parce que dans la mise en œuvre également, cet aspect peut ne pas être pris en compte. Sauf que l'avantage qu'on peut avoir avec certains bailleurs de fonds, il y a un aspect inclusion sociale et genre qui est très important et qui peut être même un filtre pour l'acceptation ou non du projet. Mais pour le cas d'espèces que nous avons étudiées, l'aspect genre n'a été institutionnalisé nulle part. Ce qui fait que c'est une faiblesse et on se rendra compte que dans la mise en œuvre, cet aspect genre n'est pas pris en compte. Dans les impacts également, c'est la négligence de la prise en compte de cet aspect genre, de la préoccupation des conditions des femmes. Donc ça, c'est un aspect. L'autre aspect, c'est que ce qu'on appelle la politique de compensation des parties prenantes, de réinstallation, on ne prend pas en compte les préoccupations des femmes. Est-ce que le fait de faire passer le projet par ce trajet, il y a un marché qui regroupe des femmes, ou bien il y a un centre de production qui est là-bas? Est-ce que ça entrave au bien-être ou bien aux intérêts des femmes? Et ce sont ces aspects-là qu'il faut inclure dans la législation, qu'il faut inclure dans le cadre institutionnel pour que dans les projets, ces aspects soient pris en compte, de telle sorte que dans toute décision, les préoccupations des femmes sont prises en compte.
Alors ma question face à ce partenariat privé-public, c'est au fond une question sur la résistance. Parce que les États africains ont été obligés d'être dans ce partenariat privé-public qui leur a été imposé par l'extérieur, par les grandes institutions financières. Est-ce que les États ont cherché d'autres solutions? Est-ce qu'il y a eu des obstacles? Est-ce qu'il y a eu des alternatives? Vous, comme économiste, est-ce que vous avez vu des changements? Ou bien est-ce qu'on va continuer à être dans ce cycle qui est un cycle quand même assez difficile?
C'est vrai qu'on peut dire qu'on a imposé aux États africains l'obligation de recourir aux parties prenantes parce que si les robinets sont fermés d'un côté, la seule solution de recours, c'est les PPP. Mais en tant qu'économiste, appréciant la valeur de l'accès au financement pour accéder à des biens et à des services, ça devient un input incontournable. Et le partenariat public-privé peut être une solution efficace à l'accès aux services. Mais il faut une prise en charge pertinente, une prise en charge qui requiert l'expertise de la part de nos États africains. Parce que sinon, c'est le privé qui y gagne et finalement, le gouvernement n'y gagne pas. On a plusieurs cas d'exemple de partenaires privés qui viennent et il n'y a aucun intérêt ou bien faible intérêt pour la population sénégalaise. Et je pense que c'est là où se trouve tout le débat sur la croissance extravertie. Parce que toute la croissance est portée par les grandes entreprises et les entreprises étrangères qui viennent avec leur main-d'œuvre, qui viennent avec leurs matériaux de production, etc., etc. Donc finalement, qu'est-ce qu'on gagne l'économie sénégalaise? Et c'est aux États africains de s'approprier l'expertise qu'il faut en matière de partenariat public-privé pour mieux négocier les contrats de concession, mais également pour mettre un cadre institutionnel qui favorise un partenariat gagnant-gagnant pour tout le monde. Et des fois, du côté de la population, c'est là où il faut une démarche participative. Mais pour moi, l'avantage, l'intérêt, c'est de dire quelle est la source de financement.